Good morning. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. I'm here to welcome you this morning for what I obviously anticipate being an interesting discussion. We're very pleased to have this morning, actually doubly pleased. So this morning we've got Ambassador Richard Jones, who's the Deputy Executive Director of the IEA, newly installed, Dr. Fatih Birol, who's responsible for the WEO, and we also have Guy Caruso joining us this morning, and that's an extreme pleasure. Guy joined us here at CSIS about a month ago, or rejoined us, I should say. He was here a decade ago, right? In the interim, he served as the head of the Energy Information Administration, so we thought it would be useful to roll him out today and have him moderate this morning's session, since this is a subject dear and near to his heart. Two quick administrative items. Since we have such a large crowd this morning, this would be a great time to turn off your cell phones, out of courtesy to the folks around you, also to our panel. There's one now. We have ways of dealing with you. And then secondly, okay. Secondly, we will post the PowerPoint probably this afternoon. We'll put it in a PDF version. This entire session is on the record. And we're really thrilled to have Ambassador Jones and Fatih here again today. This is usually where they roll out the WEO. And this is one of the reasons. So thank you very much for coming, and I'm pleased to turn this over to Guy. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank, and let me welcome all of you as well, and really a pleasure to be back at CSIS. As Frank said, you know, in between my times at CSIS, I spent the 6 years at EIA, and that was great. And it's a great pleasure and indeed a real privilege to be able to introduce the IEA team that will present the World Energy Outlook, particularly appropriate coming at a time as a new administration takes over here in Washington, that they'll have the insights from the WEO that both Dick and Fatih will present this morning. Ambassador Richard Jones has joined the International Energy Agency in October of this year after a distinguished career as a career diplomat in the U.S. Foreign Service. Dick has served in critical posts as ambassador in Lebanon, in Kuwait, Kazakhstan, and most recently to Israel. So clearly he has excelled as a diplomat, as a person who managed these embassies and really understands the geopolitical aspects. And those, all four of those posts, of course, had extremely important energy linkages, as well as serving as part of the senior diplomatic team in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, in the mid-80s. So we, as a member of the IEA, are extremely pleased that Dick has taken this assignment. He brings, as I said, a wealth of intellect, foreign policy experience, and really understands the linkages between what the IEA does and the world energy markets. And we'll hear from him as he presents an overview of the World Energy Outlook 2008. After Dick finishes that overview and some of the key findings of the WEO, he will be followed by Dr. Fatih Birol, who is a chief economist and director of all the economic analysis at the IEA. Fatih has been at the IEA since the mid-90s when we were colleagues there. And he, since taking over as the chief economist and director, he has brought some enormous intellectual rigor to the WEO process over these last more than 10 years. And this year in particular, the focus is on two really critical world energy issues, that of the availability of the resources by examining on a field-by-field basis the largest oil fields, and then some of the implications of the world energy supply-demand outlook for global climate change, which is the second main topic of the this year's WEO. So in fact, the PhD economist has taught economics in Vienna, Austria, worked in OPEC prior to coming to the IEA. So again, we are very fortunate to have both Dick Jones and Fatih Birol with us this morning. And I know it's a cold day in Washington, but please join me in giving Dick Jones a warm CSIS welcome.
Well, thank you very much for that warm introduction, Guy. I hope I can live up to it in today's presentation. Well, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I want to thank you today for joining us for the launch of the 2008 World Energy Outlook, WEO for short. As you know, the WEO is a flagship publication of the IEA. It provides a critical means by which we seek to contribute to a better understanding of the energy security and sustainability challenges facing the world. Released annually for more than a decade now, I believe I can safely say that each edition of the WEO is more important and more relevant to world affairs than any of its predecessors. This reflects growing links between energy issues and wider global concerns, such as climate change, economic prosperity, and sustainable development, as well as the increasing global energy independence. As with past versions of the WEO, this year's edition draws on the latest data and policies to provide comprehensive energy projections to the year 2030, region by region and fuel by fuel. I'm not sure why the slides are coming up. I'm probably touching some button here. So what did they say in The Wizard of Oz? Ignore the man behind the screen. I don't want to step on Fatih's presentation. But even as the WEO was being prepared, global events such as dramatically lower oil prices, falling energy demand in many regions, and above all, shocking global financial developments were pushing longer-term concerns about energy security and climate change off center stage. However, we can ill afford to ignore them. Let me remind you of something by way of a small analogy. When you drive a car, if you only fix your eyes on the road right in front of you, you will be constantly swerving back and forth to avoid even minor obstacles. However, if you focus your eyes further ahead, small corrections are all that are necessary. Looking down the road makes for a much safer, smoother ride. This is equally true in driving and in developing energy policy. So even while we are facing global financial conditions, it is vital that we keep our eyes on the medium and longer term goal of more secure, sustainable energy for all. This latest version of the WEO makes that strikingly clear. It contains some of our strongest messages yet. First, the revised global projections in this year's WEO clearly demonstrate that current trends in energy supply and consumption are unsustainable, environmentally, economically, and socially. Overall, projected energy demand in 2030 is slightly lower than we forecast in the 2007 World Energy Outlook, following downward revisions to economic growth assumptions and higher fuel price assumptions. But the report also highlights that global energy demand is still expected to grow substantially, in particular in new emerging economies like China, India, and the Middle East. Second, this edition of the WEO includes a first-of-its-kind examination of crude oil production prospects through a detailed analysis of production trends at 800 of the world's largest fields. Our research shows that production decline rates are high and likely to rise significantly in the long term. Why is this important? Well, decline rates are actually far more important for anticipating investment needs than demand growth, despite the attention focused on the latter. Even if oil demand were to remain flat to 2030, which is unlikely, 45 million barrels per day of gross capacity, roughly four times the current capacity of Saudi Arabia, would need to be built by 2030 just to offset the impact of oil field decline. We're on a treadmill, and we have to run just to stay in place. Clearly, faster natural decline rates will require more upstream investment, both in new and existing fields. In fact, the 2008 WEO shows that these trends call for energy supply investment of $26.3 trillion to 2030 in our reference scenario. That's more than $1 trillion a year. 52% of this must occur in the power sector, and most of the rest, well over $500 billion per year, must be invested in oil and gas, mainly for exploration and development, especially in non-OECD regions. Unfortunately, the current financial crisis is already impacting investment plans. Many projects have been canceled or stretched out. This could lead to a premature supply crunch, even as the economy recovers. I would reemphasize here the need to take a longer-term view and to maintain investment activities now so as to avoid another cycle of spiraling prices and recession before we know it. In this regard, as unpleasant as I find the task, I must stress that our findings make it clear that despite the free fall in oil prices in recent months, the era of low energy prices is over. Finally, another piece of bad news. In the 2008 WEO's reference scenario on current trends, energy-related emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases would cause the average global temperature to rise by as much as 6 degrees Celsius in the long term. That's more than 10 degrees Fahrenheit. This is not good news if you're a polar bear. Now, before we all go out and shoot ourselves, let me hasten to add that there is some very good news in our WEO analysis this year. The scenario that I've been describing is, in fact, not the only scenario in our report. The other scenarios, which are based on the same overall growth assumption as the reference scenario, explore what might happen if next year's COP15 conference in Copenhagen reaches agreement on a hybrid approach to climate policies, comprising a possible combination of cap-and-trade systems, sectoral agreements, and national policy measures. The findings of these scenarios emphasize the central role the energy sector can play in tackling climate change. For example, to reach a greenhouse gas stabilization scenario of 450 parts per million, we would need to see energy-related CO2 emissions reach less than 26 gigatons in 2030. To achieve this would require concerted action from all major emitters. Developed countries alone can't take care of this. It would also mean that 40% of global power generation must derive from low-carbon technologies by 2030. It would require global energy investment beyond the reference scenario of $9.3 trillion, or 0.6% of global GDP. However, there would also be savings in the world's carbon fuel bill of $5.8 trillion, in part because oil prices would be 20% less than in the reference scenario, and the expected rise in global temperatures would only be 2 degrees Celsius, less than 4 degrees Fahrenheit. Reaching such an outcome will not be easy, of course, but our analysis shows that it is possible. We have both the national and financial resources to achieve it, the natural and financial resources to achieve it. It also does not rely on pie-in-the-sky technology breakthroughs. If we fail, it won't be for lack of resources or technology, but for lack of leadership and will. It's not an exaggeration to say that the future of human well-being hinges on finding economical ways to satisfy the world's growing appetite for energy without permanently harming the environment. While the path ahead may be difficult, IEA analysis demonstrates that it does remain possible to reach the ultimate destination of a secure and sustainable energy future without sacrificing world economic growth. I want to emphasize that. All three scenarios that we deal with in report are based on the same growth assumptions. The notion that there's a trade-off between protecting the climate, protecting the environment, and economic growth is not the case in our view. In fact, we believe that investment in new energy technologies will be a major source of growth in coming decades. But this will only happen if we act on the messages contained in the WEO and other IEA analysis by taking action now. Before passing the floor to Fatih Birol, let me close by noting that it is not only governments and the private sector that must respond to new energy realities presented in this year's WEO. It's also true for international organizations, including the International Energy Agency itself. We at the IEA are acutely aware of our own need to respond to changing global conditions, such as the challenge of climate change and the increasing importance of non-IEA member countries like China, India, and the Middle East to the global energy landscape as consumers as well as producers. We, too, are taking account of and responding to our own messages in this regard. With our unique combination of experience and expertise in global energy policy, we stand ready to assist in any way possible. It's now a great pleasure for me to pass the floor to Fatih Birol, Chief Economist of the IEA, who, along with many other hardworking individuals, is the central figure behind this publication. Thank you very much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure again to come back to CSIS and make another type of presentation about the World Energy Outlook, and this time the 2008. And let me add the words of Ambassador Jones to thank the CSIS for organizing this, as well as the help we got from some of the members, such as Guy Caruso here and Frank Verastro, to peer review the earlier versions of this book. As Ambassador Jones said, we at the IEA try to provide long-term view, medium and long-term view, to our member governments and the others, what are the key strategic challenges. And after this presentation, if you have any questions to the IEA team, Ambassador Jones or Mrs. Rebecca Gagan here, head of our communication office, and myself, we will be happy to take them. This year's World Energy Outlook came out in a time where we have many other preoccupations, namely the financial crisis. And let me just start by telling you how we think the financial crisis might affect the energy picture and even some of the strategic issues. When we look at the financial crisis, I have two major worries, one on the investment front, the other one on the policy front. On the investment front, we hear almost every day that a project, oil project, upstream project, is canceled or delayed or deferred because of the low prices and the affordability of some of the companies, and sometimes on the base of deliberate production policies. So this, we think, is a significant risk. If the economy rebounds, and we hope so, when the demand picks up, we may well be caught unprepared if those investments do not go forward. And it may be in a couple of years of time, and this may well lead to difficult supply problems, which in turn may have implications on the prices, and we may end up seeing prices maybe even higher than what we have seen last summer. And again, we also see that some renewable projects, or as you call in the United States in general terms, alternative projects, are in difficulty, both in terms of economic affordability of the utilities and the lower fossil fuel prices, losing some type of competition power vis-à-vis the fossil fuel prices. The typical one in Europe is that we have gas turbines versus the wind turbines, windmills, and you have difficulties there when the oil prices go to $50 and if it was to remain so in the next years to come. So this is the worry on the investment front. And on the policy front, the bad news is mainly related to the climate change. 6 months ago, climate change was very strongly on the top of the agenda of many international institutions and governments and so on. And we now see that the preoccupation of the governments, rightly so, is focusing on the current present economic worries. And this is especially risky when we are approaching the Copenhagen meeting at the end of next year, where we hope to get an international climate agreement. So therefore, this is really worrying that the governments are focusing mainly on the current economic worries and perhaps in some cases forget the importance of climate change, which is a strategic issue. So these are the worries we have, And on the basis of that, I would like to present you our World Energy Outlook in three small sections. The first, I would like to give you the so-called the grand tableau, the big picture, how we see the energy world could develop in the next 20 years or so. The second one, I will look at the oil issues in depth, oil supply issues. And finally, a bit of a word on the climate change scenarios we have. Let me tell you what we think the world energy mix could look like in the next 20 years. This is our reference scenario. Just I wanted to make it clear. This is on the basis of policies which are legally enacted as of mid-2008. If those policies do not change, how the energy picture would or could look like. And as we say here, we think this scenario is unsustainable. This picture is unsustainable. This picture has to change because of the security of supply. This picture has to change because of the climate change implications it has. And this is a picture that we challenge to change. This is a picture that the IEA doesn't want to happen. So I wanted to underline it very boldly because in many cases, people try to, or people rightly or wrongly, identify us with the reference scenario. This reference scenario is a wake-up call, and this needs to be changed and altered because of the consequences of this scenario that I'm going to tell you in terms of oil supply and in terms of climate change. So when you look at this picture, one significant point is the issue of coal, which we don't discuss very much. We mainly discuss renewables or oil and gas. As you see here, more than one-third of the growth in the energy demand, global energy demand, is going to come from coal in the next two decades. In fact, if you forget our forecast and look at the past, what happened in the last 7 years, I find this picture very impressive because this picture shows that many meetings we have, many discussions we have, are perhaps not necessarily focusing on the right issues. We discuss on the renewables a lot, nuclear, oil, and et cetera. But when you look at this picture, in the last 7 years, the amount of energy we used, or amount of energy came from oil plus gas plus renewables plus nuclear. If you add all of them together, you come to the amount of energy we got from coal. The growth from coal is equal to the combination of all others put together. So this is rather, I think, important, and this is also shows that our discussions may want to look at the coal also in the future, perhaps carefully, perhaps the area that we are not in. It is mainly coming from Asia, and when we look at the future, we still think that the coal will play a crucial role. And more than 85% of the growth in global coal will come only from China plus India, two countries with very high electricity demand growth rates and rather low economic affordability and plus rich domestic coal reserves. A good news, I should say, that the renewables will also grow. We expect that the renewables, but when I say renewables, it is hydro plus others, like wind, solar, and the others, will become the worldwide second largest source for electricity generation, overtaking natural gas. I wanted to here highlight that the bulk of the renewables are coming here from the large hydro, and why we expect renewables to grow so strongly has three reasons. One, there is a lot of government support in many countries worldwide, in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere. Second, in many cases, the cost of producing electricity from renewables declined. And third, as Mr. Ambassador said, we expect in the medium and long term fossil fuel prices to be high, providing a competitive edge to the renewables. Of course, renewables share growing means good news in terms of the energy security and good news in terms of the climate change because they don't emit any CO2 emissions. Now, many people ask us if the oil peaked, and our answer is yes, oil peaked, And this is the oil demand in the OECD countries peaked. This is the what we are saying. This is one of the findings of our study. We think the level of the oil demand, what we have been seeing in the OECD countries, 2005-2006, we will, in aggregate terms, we will never come back to those levels. There may be zigzags in some countries, there may be some fluctuations, but in OECD aggregate terms, we expect the OECD in 2030 oil demand will be less than what we had in the last few years as a result of many factors. But the important one is that all the growth will come outside of the OECD. China, more than 40% of the global oil demand growth will come from China. India, 20% responsible of the oil demand growth, global oil demand growth, and Middle East, 20%. One of the key findings of this study is that Middle East, we have been considering Middle East as a major energy producer, supplier, oil and gas, and on top of that, we have found out that Middle East is also emerging as a new demand center, energy demand center, especially in terms of oil and gas. There are many factors behind that, the high economic growth, the high population growth, desalination projects that needs a lot of energy, plus huge subsidies for the energy products. According to our analysis in the World Energy Outlook, each year, non-OECD countries pay more than $300 billion to energy subsidies, and about $150 billion is only for oil products. Of course, this has major implications from the wasteful use of energy to the climate change or CO2 emissions trajectories. Now, in the oil demand picture, I try to show you that the OECD countries are becoming less relevant. The same applies to the supply side. When you look at the supply side here, you see that the oil, gas, and coal, in terms of growth in the production as OECD, the role of OECD countries are very, very small. The big portion of the growth will come outside of the OECD countries, from the countries in Middle East, former Soviet Union, and others. This will have, of course, major implications in terms of the energy security of the OECD countries, as well as some of the major economies in Asia. We need each year $1 trillion for energy investments, oil, gas, coal, electricity. Just perhaps to make one point clear here is that we talk about the oil investments a lot, but more than half of the investments need to go to electricity generation. And in the future, if we have to make more use of renewables and more use of nuclear, the capital intensity will be higher, and this share may be even higher than what we have here. But as you see here, more than half of it needs to go to electricity generation. And again, I gave you the example of the postponed investments in the oil and gas upstream sector and its implications, and we may have major difficulties in terms of electricity projects, especially in the developing countries. Now, after giving this general picture on the energy, let me turn to the second part of our presentation, namely the oil supply prospects. We think that the non-OPEC convention oil is not very promising, and it reached a plateau, and it is going to decline significantly. And the bulk of the growth in oil need to come from the key OPEC countries. And when you look at the share of OPEC, it is about 44% today in the global oil supply. It needs to increase 51% in 2030, with, of course, major implications on the oil industry. And here, there are two countries which are very important. All the key Middle East countries are important, but two of them I want to underline. One is Saudi Arabia, and it is, as always, underlined the the key country in terms of increasing the production, which has been a reliable partner for several years in the past, which can increase the production, one. Second is Iraq. Iraq has huge potential, easy geology, lower cost of production, but as it stands now, it is how much oil we will get from Iraq will is a function of how the country's stability will look like in the next years to come and how much investment can go to Iraq. But in any case, we expect the share of OPEC countries in the future will need to increase if we were to meet the growth in the global oil demand. Now, one of the key findings of our study is on the looking at the situation of the existing fields. We have analyzed about 800 fields on a field-by-field basis this year, a unique study whose results are publicly available and to our knowledge for the first time. What we have done is that we look at 800 fields of the world, and it makes more than three-fourths of the existing reserves, about two-thirds of the global production. It covers all the supergiant fields, bulk of the giant fields, and a major amount of the large fields. And when we look at the field by field, we look at the decline rates of the fields after they come to a peak. After the peak, how much they decline on a yearly basis, and what does it mean for us? To be honest with you, we were a bit surprised that the decline rates were a bit higher than we thought before. And this is not the bad news. The bad news is that we understood that it will be even higher in the future, mainly because of the fact that in the future the oil will come from smaller size fields, and more oil will need to come from offshore fields. And typically these two types of fields have higher decline rates compared to supergiant fields we have. So this is more of a bit of a technical information perhaps, but I wanted to highlight one issue. This is the, if I may say so, I don't know if it is the right English or not, the mission, the very mission of this book in terms of oil supply is the following. Normally, we think how much we need to increase the oil production capacity, we think we need to increase the production capacity as much as the demand grows. China is growing, India is growing, so we have to increase the production in order to meet the growth in China and India. And this is wrong. Or this is partly true, I should say. This is partly true. We need, more important than that, we need to increase the production in order to compensate the decline in the existing field. This is the primary task and more difficult task. And the second task is to meet the growth in the oil demand growth. You see this dark blue or deep blue color. It is declining, and we have to find a way. We have to bring new oil markets in order to compensate that decline. And we have calculated that if our production today, or our oil use today is about 86 million barrels per day, if the oil demand was flat for 25 years, which is very, very, very unlikely, it's impossible, of course, if it was to stay like that, as Ambassador Jones said, we need to increase the production by 45 million barrels per day just to stay there. And if you want to, on top of that, meet the growth in the oil demand, which we estimate about 20 million barrels per day in the next 25 years, we have to increase the production about 64 million barrels per day, which means six new Saudi Arabias. So is it possible or not? This depends on who you are and how you are. You're optimist or pessimist, careful, less careful. But I wanted to bring one issue to your consideration, which I believe is a crucial one, and sometimes we focus too much on the geological facts only and forget this very picture. This dark blue color I show you is in the previous picture is mainly owned by the international oil companies, and the reserves they are owning is declining significantly. And there, the reserves, which are outside of their control, they have difficulties to access and book those reserves and make production out of those reserves. And those reserves are mainly under the control of the national oil companies. We expect that more than 80% of the growth in oil and natural gas need to be produced by the national oil companies if we want to find this six Saudi Arabias. Now, this means the following. First of all, this means there is a sea change in the oil industry. Rules of the game will change. I mean, you play up to now, perhaps we were playing football up to now, and we changed to another game, which one ball, which can be rugby. It will be a different type of game with different rules. It is going to change. Because national oil companies have their own priorities, and their, when they make decisions on the investments, these are not necessarily the same like the international oil companies. I don't want to say one is good, one is bad. I don't want to make any comment on that. I'm very careful here. But it's a bit different. National oil companies have tasks such as building hospitals, building schools, infrastructure. And in many cases, it is the single natural revenue generator of those countries. It is different. In the international oil companies phase, if I may say so, companies which were responsible more than 50% of the growth, despite their small share in the global reserves in the last two decades, they were looking at the oil prices, market dynamics, and so on. But when the dominance of the national oil companies is going to be felt more and more in the future, the rules of the game will change. And therefore, when we look at the Six Saudi Arabia challenge, it is not only or the challenge of the reserves, the geology, but perhaps more importantly, the issue of the investment, which is, of course, aggravated by the decline rate challenges. So this is the second point I wanted to make to you today from the World Energy Outlook, how we see the oil markets to develop. Finally, we would like to share with you our views on the climate change. When we look at the climate change issue, energy sector is very important. We are responsible more than two-thirds of the emissions in the which causes the climate change. So if we have such a responsibility in terms of the emitting the CO2 emissions, it is also on our shoulder to propose how we can fix that problem. And we believe very much, as the International Energy Agency, that the energy sector's voice must be more and more heard in the international climate change negotiations, because we are responsible more than two-thirds of the emissions. And if there's a solution, this solution will have major implications on the energy sector in terms of investments and the others. When we look at the emissions in the next years, carbon dioxide, which is the most important gas, we think the OECD countries' emissions are more or less flat, and the bulk of the emissions are coming from the non-OECD countries. Again, China, India, and Middle East are the most important countries in terms of the growth of the emissions. But in 2015, if you look at the volumes in terms of emissions, the top three countries in terms of CO2 emissions are number one, China, number two, United States, and number three, India. And they three put together make more than 50% of the global CO2 emissions in 2015. So this trajectory that we see here is a bad one. It is in line with a trajectory which will bring us a path which is in line up to 6 degrees Celsius increase in the temperature. I forgot the Fahrenheit version, 10 degrees in Fahrenheit, which will have major implications ranging from availability of food to the life of the species, the sea level rise, huge amount of immigration from a country X to country Y. So the implications for everybody, rich, poor, producer, consumer, for everybody. So there is no way going out of that. So the good news is, this was the bad news, the good news is that now everybody nowadays agree that we have to do something. All the countries, more or less, in the world. This is a good news, good start. But the problem is we cannot agree who is going to do what among the countries. This is the problem. And as International Energy Agency, looking at from the perspective of the energy, we are coming with a so-called policy framework for following the Kyoto. We are going to suggest you now. We have lots of discussion in our book. And in 2009, in November, getting your reactions, everybody's reactions on this framework we are going to present you now. And in the next months, we will make our final proposal for Copenhagen and put it on the table. So what do we do? We do the following. Countries currently have very different policy preferences in terms of how to deal with the climate change. There are three preferred policies, very roughly summarized. The first one is cap and trade. The second one is making international sectoral agreements in order to improve the efficiency in given sectors, such as iron, steel, such as cement, and others. And the third one, especially preferred by the poor developing countries, is not to have binding agreements, but voluntary policies and measures to improve the efficiency, to have more this policy, that policy, and so on. So what we have done is for two different trajectories, 3 degrees and 2 degrees, vis-a-vis the 6 degrees, which is the bad one, we looked at how can we deal with that. Now, this looks a bit complicated, but it is much less complicated than the real life is. I will tell you what it is. First of all, we have divided countries into 3 groups, and they're in fact divided more than 3. There are about 33 different positions, but we have divided into 3 groups. OECD countries, other major economies such as China, India, Russia, and Middle East, and other countries which are the very poor countries. In a 550 ppm means it brings us to a 3 degrees Celsius increase, that trajectory. Don't forget that reference scenario was bringing us to a 6 degrees increase, and the 500 is much better than that. We need a 3 degrees increase here. And here we thought in the OECD countries there could be for electricity generation and industry, most of the industry, we can have cap and trade. And in the industry, in iron and steel, cement, and for car manufacturers and aircraft manufacturers, we have agreements to reach a certain level of efficiency improvements. For example, the car efficiency in terms of how much CO2 you emit in 100 kilometers, car manufacturers come together, the aircraft manufacturers come together and make agreements, put some targets to improve that their efficiency. In the year 2030, we want to reach that. This sector approach is very appropriate for the sectors where you have very few number of players and decision makers, such as the aircraft manufacturers and the others. In the national policy and measures, these are mainly on a voluntary basis. Cap and trade is very important. In Europe, we have already a cap and trade system. In some Asian countries, we have cap and trade system. And we know that the forthcoming U.S. administration puts cap and trade as a key option in order to address the climate change. So this can be a start for a climate deal. And the point here is that this requires the minimum divergence of the countries' current positions what they have now. That it will require minimum divergence, which is, I think, our aim. And as I will show you, we need big countries to be involved in that. And if you want to go to 450 ppm, this was for 3 degrees. If you want to for 2 degrees. Increase, which is what everybody wants to see. Wants to see is different than that if we can do it or not, but everybody wants to see a 2 degrees increase, then we need to have the Middle East countries, China, India, and the others in a cap and trade system, because we need larger reductions. So we have 3 scenarios, 6 degrees, 550, which is 3 degrees, and 450, which is 2 degrees. So here, what do we have to do for that? We have to do the following. This is our reference scenario, 6 degrees, and this is our 550 scenario, which is 3 degrees, and this is comes to the 450. 450 is the one which has been recommended by the G8 leaders, first in Heiligendamm, then in Japan in the G8 leaders meeting, and also by the United Nations. But this is a bit difficult to achieve. What does it mean? I will tell you in concrete terms. It's up to you again to decide. We don't want to decide on anything. We bring the facts on the table. To come to a 450, first of all, you need four major policies: more energy efficiency, more renewables, more carbon capture and storage, and more nuclear power. And I will put them in a context now. In terms of energy efficiency, in order to reach that improvement by 2030, having this 54% of reduction, what we have to do is we have to improve the global energy efficiency. Between 2000 and 2007, in the last 7 years, global energy efficiency increased by 1% per year. And in order to come to that 450 target, we have to increase it each year 2.4%. So the order of magnitude of the challenge. In terms of renewables, and here, for example, let me give an example of wind, what everybody is talking about. In 2007 was the record year we have the installed capacity of wind, which is, according to statistics, about 90 gigawatts. And we reached that 90 gigawatt globally as a result of huge efforts and huge subsidies of the governments in the last two decades. In order to reach that wind target in 450, we have to build each year 45 gigawatts. It means half of what we have built in the last 20 years, the challenge. In terms of nuclear power, which we think is a very important policy both for energy security and climate change, we have to build, in order to reach that target, 20 nuclear power plants each year, and currently we are building 1.5. And carbon capture and storage, a technology which is very, very crucial when you look at the coal numbers we showed to you, especially in China and India, carbon capture and storage, a technology which is very promising, definitely, but not yet up and running. There are some problems that we have to fix in terms of technology, in terms of economics, and in terms of a legal framework. So there is an important challenge. Let me show you one more slide, which I think is the biggest challenge of the climate change for me than the technology challenge or the finance challenge. This three bars shows you the amount of CO2 emissions we reach in 2030. In the green one, 450, that we all want to reach, as the United Nations tells us, the total global emissions need to come to 25 gigaton in 2030, in the green one. And when you look at the first bar, this red and yellow, these beautiful colors, if we assume that the OECD countries, this shows the reference scenario with the current policies in place, if we were to assume that the OECD countries' emissions were to be zero, go down to zero, we can still not reach the 450 target. It means, in other words, if tomorrow in all OECD countries, US, Europe, Japan, all OECD economies were to crash, which we are very close to anyways, but if it was a crash and stay there 25 years, no cars are running, no power plants are working, no lights are burning, nothing is happening, zero emissions, zero economic activity, if the other countries wouldn't move, we are not able to reach the 450 ppm. This is the bad message. And worst message is that those countries are not necessarily putting the climate change on the top of their agenda, the countries who should move. So how we are going to reconcile these emission trends with their political interests, I think this will be the challenge that we are going to face in Copenhagen. So let me just try to summarize our scenarios and finish our presentation. In the 550 or 3 degrees scenario, we need to change the energy demand, and we need a CO2 price about $90 per ton in the OECD countries, and the additional investments we have to make in the energy sector, on the energy sector, would be equal to 0.25% of the global GDP each year. In terms of 450, which is much more challenging, which will bring us to a 2 degrees increase in the Earth's temperature, we have to make major efforts getting new technologies in place, including carbon capture and storage. And in this case, the CO2 prices would be $180 per ton. And again, in this case, the additional investments would mean 0.6% of the global GDP each year only from the energy sector. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's finish our presentation by trying to put our thoughts together. As Ambassador Jones said, we are on an unsustainable trend. And Frank Verastra may remember last year I said exactly the same thing. And I will say the same thing next year if I am invited again, because I am only responsible to make the book, not the policies. So therefore, we are in that trend and nothing is changing. And in fact, when you look at our previous projections in the last 5 years, they are perfectly in line with what is going on in the life. Our reference scenario is becoming the path that we are following, unfortunately, I should say. In terms of oil, we think it will be the leading energy source in next years to come. Even though we may see ups and downs in the prices, the era of cheap oil is over for many reasons that we try to highlight. Again, our contribution to the public debate in oil, that we think the decline in the existing fields are much more important than the demand growth in terms of our challenges in terms of investments. And the fact that oil market is going through a sea change that we all have to note, and not only the sea change, but it is consequences for the markets and beyond. In terms of the climate change, we think this is a very important issue, and this is, unlike the financial crisis, this is irreversible, and we have to take our measures, especially in the energy sector, and we hope to see that the Copenhagen provides a framework which we can all follow and which we can all agree. And again, limiting the temperature to 2 degrees 450 will be very, very challenging, and we need new technologies and also all the countries to be on the game. One issue that I wanted to say finally here is that the climate change and energy security, sometimes in some countries, I don't want to give the name of the country, but in some countries, some administrations have a lot of emphasis on oil supply. And when these administrations go, when the others come, they put a lot of emphasis on the climate change. And we think, as the International Energy Agency, that bulk of the policies that we suggest, efficiency, renewables, nuclear, and the others, would address both energy security and climate change issues. So we have to look at the picture from that angle, perhaps in the future. And again, to finish the presentation, how we started with, that we believe that the present economic worries shouldn't be an excuse for the governments and the others to backtrack from the steps we were making in terms of diversifying the energy mix, improving the energy efficiency, and trying to address the climate change issues. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, Ambassador Jones, Fatih, thank you very much for that sobering view. And while we're going to take questions and answers now, while you're thinking about your questions, let me start off with, since Dick Jones is new to the role of Deputy Executive Director, he's had to do a lot of thinking about what IEA will do, and now he's seen the kind of environment that the IEA and its member countries will operate under in this reference scenario. Dick, what I know it's early, but what are your initial thoughts about the role IEA can or should play in this? You can
I'll stand up because otherwise people.
Yeah, it's hard to see from
the mic. Let's pull the podium back. Thanks very much, Guy. As Fatih's presentation, I think, makes abundantly clear, we can't do this alone. The IEA was founded 35 years ago to address the security needs of our member countries, and we continue to do that. In the old days, it was primarily focused on ensuring the supply of oil, and we talked a lot about strategic stockpiles. Of course, we built those stockpiles. We built mechanisms for coordinating amongst our member countries the release of those stockpiles, and in fact, we have released those stockpiles to respond to dramatic events such as the Gulf War, such as the Katrina, Rita, hurricane twin crisis. So up until now, we've primarily focused on working amongst our member countries. But as this presentation makes abundantly clear, it's not sufficient to work just with our member countries anymore. We have to reach out to the rest of the countries in the world. We have to reach out to the major consuming countries. We have to reach out to the producing countries. And because this is a problem that's too big for any one country, it's too big for the OECD even, or the IEA membership, to solve on their own. So we can only do it if we are able to enlist the cooperation of the key drivers of the energy economy. And as we can tell, this is China, this is India, this is the states of the Middle East in particular. So what can the IEA do with that? Well, what one thing we have been doing for many years is engaging with these countries on a technical level. We have been very active with China and India, in particular with the states of Southeast Asia. We've had a dialogue with OPEC. Fatih is primarily responsible for interacting with the OPEC Secretariat. But we interact with the individual OPEC countries. We participated in the process that was launched at Jeddah. We'll be at the meeting in London at the end of this year in December that follows up the Jeddah meeting. But we have been, for many years, been working at the technical level. We do a lot of technical training. It's not sexy, but one of the basic services that the IEA has provided to its member countries over the last 35 years is building data sets and making sure that the data is harmonious, so that it's consistent across countries in our member states. Well, we're now trying to do that in the world. We do a lot of training for statisticians from non-member countries. We want to do that more. We want to actually found an IEA training center. Of course, it will take money. We're not sure we can get that money, but we're going to be asking our member countries, we're going to be asking companies and foundations to help us to support the construction of such a center so that we can do more to train people at the technical level. But we also need to do more to engage these people at the policy level. And that's something that we have been doing. We have invited key countries, particularly China, India. Russia is another one that we shouldn't leave out because Russia is a producer, but it's also a very large consumer, and a lot of energy is wasted in Russia. And as I think we've pointed out here today, energy efficiency is half the battle. Literally 54% of the reduction in emissions that we feel we need to reach the 450 scenario will come from just promoting energy efficiency. And Russia is a country, as somebody who's lived in the former Soviet Union, I can tell you that there's plenty of energy that's wasted. And they know that, and they want to address that. So we're engaging them. In fact, we have something called the Partnership for Energy Efficiency. I forget what the R stands for, but it's PEER for short. We are in the process right now of working with Russia, China, and India, but also Brazil, Mexico, and South Africa to develop something called IPEC, which is the International Partnership for Energy Efficiency Cooperation. So we've got a number of initiatives going. We've opened the doors to many of our committees to participation by key non-member countries, and we're still looking for ways that we can broaden that. A lot of people have called for the creation of an international energy agency. Well, we feel that we have an international energy agency already, which not only has credibility with our member states, but credibility with many of the key countries that we need to engage. And so we think that we're the platform on which we should build the outreach, and we're going to do everything we can to demonstrate to people that we're a sound platform on which to base that cooperation. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. And now we can take questions from the audience. Let's start right here. Please state your name and affiliation with the there should be a microphone coming in.
Leonard Oberlander, independent consultant. The message is very clear about the oil fields production, investments in climate change, the roles of national oil companies. I'd like to ask you, what is, in your opinion, the significance of the following? The need for overland transport of the oil and gas, overland transport for natural gas and oil, and tanker vessels for liquid natural gas and oil. Also the significance in this regard to specialty steel production and technology for specialty pipes and pipeline production. And third, with regard to the first two, the newly formed less than a month ago Gaz OPEC that was charted, and the initial three signatories being Russia, Iran, and Qatar. Thank you.
Thanks, Leonard. Let's take maybe two more, and then we could group the questions. Let's see. Brandon down in the first row here. Take two more questions, then ask Fatih and Dick to respond.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Ryan with Clean Skies TV News. I noticed the clean coal technology takes a big part of your reductions there. We know there are questions about how fast that can develop. In fact, some people question whether it can develop. Can you tell me your views on how fast you expect this to come online? What are the uncertainties, and what do you do if it doesn't work?
Pass to Joe Dukert on your right there. Then we'll answer.
Joe Dukert, I'm an independent energy analyst, and my question sort of follows on that one. A year ago, Dr. Barol, when you made a presentation here, I remember vividly that you summarized by saying, can we meet the challenge? We have the technology. We have the capital. What we lack is time. I was struck by the fact that you never once mentioned time. And since we're trying to develop short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals, I wonder if you could say something about the time framework from here to 2030.
Okay, thank you.
I can talk about the gas.
Okay. So why don't you take the gas topic first?
I'll stand up again. I didn't realize the crowd is much bigger than I can see from here, so it's good to have a chance to stand up. I'll just talk briefly about the gas OPEC. I mean, first of all, I think that's jumping quite ahead in terms of the ability or the even the intent of the parties that have come together to form this organization, if you can even call it an organization. I think at this stage it's more they're talking to each other. And the key reason is there are fundamental differences between the gas and oil markets. When you have a gas, I mean, the gas is primarily delivered by pipeline. It's true more and more LNG capability is being created, but at this time, it's a relatively small percentage of the market that's being carried by LNG. Most of the pipeline is most of the gas markets are served by pipelines, and a pipeline is a big investment, and it's pretty fixed. You know where it starts, you know where it ends, and it makes for fragmented markets. There really is no world market for gas today. The growth in LNG will gradually over time create linkages between markets, but there really isn't a market today. And the producers are much more dependent on their customers than in the oil market, because it's harder to switch between customers. For example, I think the figures are, and please don't hold me to it if it's not exactly correct, but basically Right now, Russia, for example, supplies 30% of Europe's gas. And, you know, that certainly sounds like Europe has got a great dependency on Russia. But if you turn it around, Europe buys 70% of Russia's production. So who's got who? And I think that that is the sort of difference that you see that's because of the fixed nature of the transportation routes, and it limits your number of customers. And so gas is much more like a monopoly-monopsony relationship than I think in the oil market. So we're looking at this. We're following what the parties are saying. In fact, we've been asked already by our member countries to look at gas security, and we're developing proposals now to be put to our member states. Nothing immediately imminent. Probably towards the end of next year, we may have some recommendations to put to our member states. But at this time, we're watching it, but we're not running to push the alarm bells on those developments.
Let me continue the other questions. But one point on the gas is that just to tell you that next World Energy Outlook 2009, what we did this year for oil, we want to do for natural gas next year. And I personally believe natural gas is the least transparent fuel. I don't know if it's right English or not. There's a very least transparent fuel in terms of the contracts and in terms of how the deals are made. So we want to, again, to shed some light on the gas issue in terms of the production, the investments, contracts, pricing, and other implications. The transport for oil and gas will be more and more important because the distance between the demand centers and the production centers are getting longer and longer, and this would have many implications. And one of them I can tell you, perhaps, given the current debate, if you look at our book, you will see that we have highlighted four major choke points in the world, Hormuz, Bab el-Mandab, and the others, which says that in the future, a big portion of the global oil demand will need to be met by the oil which is going to go through from those choke points. We call them, we are all from the 60th generation in my office, dire straits. So they are dire straits. So to see that in the case of an accident, in the case of a piracy, or in the case of a terrorist attack, it will have very strong implications for the global oil supply and the global oil markets. This is one of the implications. We have a very nice map in our book. If you have chance, you may want to look into that. In terms of coal, I think this is exactly the point I tried to make. Without addressing the coal issue, we have no chance whatsoever. We can build X thousands of windmills. We cannot fix the problem because coal is coming from China and India. And in many cases, carbon capture and storage, I mentioned three major barriers, technology, cost, and regulatory barriers. And in terms of cost, if a Chinese government, if they were to build one normal conventional coal-fired power plant vis-a-vis a carbon capture and storage equipped, if the cost difference is 1 to 4, why should they, as they think they are not responsible for climate change, why should they pay for that money? Why shouldn't they go for the conventional one? So who is going to pay the difference, even the technology is mature? I think this is the point. And we think, as the IEA, there's a big role for the IEA governments to push the clean coal technologies, and we are going to, in Poznan, there's the United Nations meeting at the end of this year on the climate change, and next year in Copenhagen, we are going to suggest that the countries which go for the clean coal technologies should get credits in a possible and a likely international climate change agreement, which can be, which should be in one way or another, should be credited from the international climate funds. So this is definitely climate for us, without the clean coal technologies, without the CCS, it is impossible to fix the problem. Very difficult. We call it, this is the litmus test for the governments, how serious they are to deal with the this issue. If CCS doesn't work, then the burden on the other solutions we have will increase exponentially and will make it very, very difficult to achieve, especially the 450 ppm scenario. So then we have to also look the implications for the 550 ppm, it means 3 degrees scenario, in the absence of carbon capture and storage, or in other words, clean coal technologies. The time is very important. I mean, I didn't mention this, but if you have a chance, if you read our, I think we already distribute our executive summary, which is our manifesto, if I may say so, of the IEA. It finishes, it's a very nicely written in a very literature way, and it finishes by the following, the whole 8 pages of the executive summary finishes with the following sentence: time is running out and the time to act is now. This is the last sentence of the World Energy Executive Summary. Why? Because the energy investments are need long lead times. When you make an investment, when you build a power plant, it will be with you 60 years. And now, in the absence of any climate change-related signal, in China and India, we are building a tremendous amount of power plants, coal-fired power plants, which will be with us 50, 60 years, their economic lifetime, and it will be becoming more and more difficult and more costly to find a solution if we want to shut them down prematurely before the economic lifetime is over. So time is very important, and it is the reason why we are highlighting as the IEA that the Copenhagen can give us a very good chance to give right signals to the energy sector to make the right decisions.
Thank you. We have some down here. Secretary Schlesinger and Administrator Grunsbeck.
Thank you. We have had an interesting set of statistical projections and of statistical requirements. And you mentioned pessimism and optimism, and I'd like to put you on the pessimism and optimism scale. Each of those requirements has a probability. I just mentioned some of them. What is the probability of 6 Saudi Arabia's being discovered? What are the probability of getting the investment of $26 billion, of which roughly half will be oil? What is the probability of stabilizing CO2? To mention some lesser questions, such as increasing efficiency from 1% to 4% per year, and getting 20 nukes a year. All of these probabilities must be multiplied together. So I ask for your gut reaction. Are you a pessimist or an optimist?
Howard? Well, I don't know if I want to follow that one. I noticed that in the WS scenarios and in your talk, you associate specific temperature increases with the reference 450 and 550 scenarios. My understanding had been that climate sensitivity is itself uncertain, so we really don't know what the temperature outcomes would be. Could be worse, could be better. I'll be a little more optimistic than my colleague. I'm just curious, you know, at some point, is it the concentrations we're after or the temperatures we're after, and how does that affect, you know, your reasoning? Second of all, you talk, and we struggle about the rise of capital costs for energy projects. You mentioned in WEO, certainly reflects recent experience. But, and this is, I'm trying to get some help from my own work. How do you address this looking forward? Does WEO assume that the recent increases are permanent? Does it assume that they're a bubble? Does it assume some combination of the two? Because that strikes me as pretty important, and it's not quite clear what conclusion to draw. And the last one is the timing of these sort of investment flows and the returns to the investment flows. You talk about the extra investment in the climate scenarios and then the savings that accrue, but you do you add them up to 2030, or do you take account of the fact that the investment occurs before the savings accrue? Thank you.
Well, we
good job, by the way.
Let's answer those. There's several. There's a number of questions there, and then we'll come over to this side after, right after.
So, Mr. Secretary's question is very tough, of course. I can tell you we are international civil servants, and we just put the facts on the table. But I can tell you that I am before I started to work on this World Energy Outlook, as Guy mentioned, in the last few years, 4 or 5 years, I was responsible for this work. Before that, I was an optimist person. And recently, I am becoming more and more pessimist by nature. The reason is that, Mr. Secretary, I tried to mention 5 years ago when we make this the trends, we said these are the trends which are terrible and needs to change. And we think that the government should do everything in order to change them. And this is a wake-up call, both for oil security and climate change. And when I look at 5 years ago, what our trends are for today, it is not necessarily in line, and we are worse than our bad scenario. So we are not even on the track in the bad scenario. We are worse than the bad scenario. This is the reason. What makes me rather pessimistic is the inaction from the governments. I have noticed, and I think that it is very important that some governments, for example, U.S. government, takes the lead. And as Mr. Ambassador said, the leadership is very important here, and turn the policies and try to address these issues to understand that the energy and the climate change, both of the issues are and their consequences are beyond the energy and climate change, ranging from national security to our daily life. So in terms of numbers, I am pessimistic. In terms of the past record of the governments, I am pessimistic. But there is definitely room for optimism. As we said, some of the policies are there, some of the technology is there, the finance is there, and we need some leadership worldwide to take it over and go ahead. Okay.
I completely agree with Fatih, and I would just sum it up. I'm optimistic that it can be done. I'm pessimistic that it will be done.
And Mr. Ambassador is optimistic because he just recently came to IEA. So,
hey, I worked in the Middle East.
Okay, so the question about the stabilizers, the temperature increase. Yeah, we look at the following chain: CO2 emissions, total greenhouse gas emissions, and the concentration, and the therefore the temperature increase. Of course, we work with the IPCC. This is the International Panel for Climate Change, with their own work. And our scenarios for 550, 450, and reference scenario is in the middle of the ranges, as we show in our book, what they think the CO2 emissions will end up in terms of the temperature increase. So this leads us to those, this trend leads us to those temperature increase. Cost increase, I mean, we have to distinguish two things from each other. We think the producing oil in the future will be more and more costly because it will come from more difficult places in terms of the geology. It will come also from many oil will come from offshore, and we think also a lot of oil will need to come from the non-conventional oil, which are in general costly. But in terms of, if you want to talk about the cost inflation we have seen as a result of many recent developments in terms of the increase in the steel prices, labor problems, in terms of rig problems, we did not foresee a further increase in those cost elements. We assumed a flat in the next 25 years to come. In terms of timing, the numbers we have been giving are the cumulative costs, And the number I gave about being the 0.6% of the GDP is on a yearly basis, and it is in the year 2030. If you make it on the average, it may be between now and 2030, plus it will come around 0.4 or 0.38, but in 2030 it reaches 0.6% of the GDP. Again, it is high or low, it is up to the person to judge. Again, this is for the global, and it changes from country to country and sector to sector. Some countries suffer more than the others. Some sectors suffer more than the others.
Okay. I think we got time maybe for a few more questions. Brandon, the young lady in the pink here, and then
thanks.
In the back, and Mark Finley.
Michelle from the Economic Observer, a newspaper based in Beijing. I wonder, beyond the technical level and the policy level, are you considering to accept some non-OECD countries to be members of IEA like China and India, or you think it's not necessary? Thanks.
All the way in the back there. Then let's, Mark would be the next.
Thank you. Robert Ciaretta, President of International Investor. I'd like to cut to the chase. Forgive my voice. I'm getting over a cold here. On one matter, and that is simply we've seen the price of oil fall almost $100 from its peak just 4 months ago. With such wild swings, would you not admit that any attempt to gauge the price of oil is much more a matter of speculation rather than the fundamentals? In other words, of that $100 swing, would you not admit that that was largely a matter of speculation rather than fundamentals?
Mark Finley with BP. Thank you both for the presentation. As always, very helpful. I'm struck that there was very little mention of market forces. And I'd be interested in your role, your view on the role of market forces for, in the outlook and the alternative policy cases, are they part of the solution or part of the problem in your mindset?
Of course, the IEA is very interested in and in always expanding our membership. We have just this year accepted the membership of Poland as a member of the IEA. According to the way our charter is written, the IEP, which is the name of the treaty upon which the IEA is based, any member of the IEA has to be a member of the OECD already. But we are, you know, open to new arrangements, and certainly if we get requests for membership from countries that are not in the OECD, we'll consider that very very seriously. Up until now, all of the countries that have expressed an interest in joining the IEA have already been OECD member countries, and in fact, almost all of the OECD member countries are members of the IEA. They're not all members, but I think only two are not, and we are open to proposals for membership from any quarter, and we would discuss those with the members of our board and see how we could accommodate those requests.
Okay, very briefly, two last questions. It is, of course, very difficult to estimate the price of oil, and our assumptions are, our numbers are assumption. If with these oil prices, where do you go into, and our assumption is, just to tell you that between 2008 and 2015, oil prices will be on average around $100, on average. Around $100. But your question is mainly about the recent fall of the prices. I agree with you that the speculation did play a role, definitely, and the big fall of the prices showed that. But the main, how the oil prices were determined was mainly as a result of the fundamentals. Speculations have amplified those trends. Mark's question is a very important one. Again, another important question about the market forces and prices. In fact, one could easily write another book on the basis of this world, the role of price. And I am very sorry to tell that I think the role of price in oil will be less and less pronounced in the future compared to past. On the demand side, the demand will come from the countries where, A, you have very strong economic growth. Therefore, the effect of the price vis-a-vis demand will be less pronounced. And the second, where the demand will come, you will have subsidies. You have strong consumer subsidies, the international prices. Whatever the prices are, it will not go through and affect the consumers. Let me give one example to you. 73, 74, when the prices went up, the oil prices, as a reaction to that, oil demand went down significantly. 79.80, when the again the oil prices went up, as a result of that, the oil demand went down, and these are both in line with the economic theory. But when you look at the 2004-2007, when the oil prices went up, oil demand did also go up. This is a bit bizarre. So normally, in line with the economic theory, you expect it should come down. So the reason why I'm saying is that the demand is becoming less sensitive to the prices, and this is very important to note. Second, on the supply side, again, as I tried to mention, the increasing dominance of the national oil companies may mean that the prices will play less of a role compared to past in terms of the production investment decisions. There may be other factors play a role there, and in terms of climate change, of course. Both for climate change and for oil, we as the IEA think that the prices should play a much more of an important role. Market forces should play a much more important role, and therefore the barriers should be removed. In terms of climate change, it is the reason why we think cap and trade is a very important system to give signals to the to polluters. But unfortunately, the situation is that if we cannot put a new framework, it is going to a direction where the role of prices will be less of an important, perhaps in a market, in an energy sector where the markets play a much more important role. And this is where we are heading, unfortunately, for the time being.
Thank you. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop the question period now and end this because Ambassador Jones and Dr. Birrell have, as you can imagine, more presentations for them. And so I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking Ambassador Jones and Dr. Birrell for their excellent presentations. Thank you.